Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
How we begin our music journey today. Thank you so much for joining us, Sheldon. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening.
Oh, that's what a lovely way to start this feature today.
Yeah, something smooth and gentle.
Very, very smooth and gentle. And
we won't end so gently.
What were you thinking here?
So the theme today is Workers' Day, obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's Workers' Day. So we thought we would focus on Workers' Day themed songs. Now, this isn't really a Workers' Day themed song, but I just thought it's quite an interesting song, how it fits into the Michael Jackson discography. So it's one of his last songs. It was released in the year that he passed away. And just prior to passing away, he had just launched this massive world tour that he was, well, not a world tour. It was going to be a residency at the O2 Arena in the UK. And he was going to do this concert tour. It was going to be 50 shows at the O2 Arena. And people were saying, there's no way he's going to make it. I mean, he's too old. He's been out of the game for too long. There's too many shows, and there's no way he's going to make this concert. Anyway, inevitably, he didn't. And there was a whole big thing in the run-up. He had a doctor with him. That was part of the insurance policy, that he had to have a doctor with him 24 hours a day. The doctor's what landed up being the part of his demise.
I was
going to
say, the ones that killed him.
Yeah. So he had to have a doctor. There was an insurance policy. There was a whole big thing leading up to the concert. And interestingly enough, at the press conference where he launched the concert, he said, I'm doing these 50 shows. It was actually a few less than 50. It was like 30. I'm going to do these 30 shows, and this is it. I'm not doing any more. It's finished. I'm never going on the road again. Anyway, when they launched, it was so popular that they added another 20 shows to the series. Anyway, so the song itself was written by a Canadian artist called Paul Anka and Michael Jackson. The two of them wrote it together, and it was meant to be in a 1980 duet album that Paul Anka was going to release. But the song never landed up on that duet album because the demos got stolen, and Paul Anka didn't know who stole them, and he was trying to search for them, never knew where they were, and eventually Michael Jackson found them in a box of things that he had. And Paul Anka was like, you've made a copy of these, and you've got them somewhere. Anyway, Michael denied it, etc., etc. And the song was actually titled something else. It was I Never Heard. That was the original title. 1991, a band releases the song. Paul Anka gives him permission to release the song. The song gets released. And then in 2009, this Michael Jackson version is released. The original demo that was stolen only had Michael Jackson's voice and a piano. So when you hear this, you can hear it there. Mm. Anyway, and so just the piano and the Michael Jackson voice. In this recording, you'll hear the Jackson 5 in the background.
Yes.
So they sing in the background. And then the song gets released in 2009. And all of these music listeners are like, this sounds like a lot like the song that was released by a band called Sapphire in 1990. And Paul Anka said, it's the same song. They've just changed the title. Anyway, Michael Jackson's estate then said, yes, it is the same song. And we'll give you 50% songwriting credit on the song because they both wrote it together. Anyway, Paul Anka said, well, at least they did the right thing. But the reason why I chose this specific song is when the documentary, so a documentary was then released of the making of the concert tour, because they were very far along. Michael Jackson died a few weeks before the first concert was supposed to be aired. Anyway, so they had this camera crew that was filming the whole thing. They're obviously going to release a documentary about the concert.
I remember the cameras all the time following him. Yeah.
So and people were talking about how emaciated he was. Anyway, when the documentary was finally released, you could see Michael Jackson was in a really bad place. He was very thin. Mm. He looked like he was on his last legs. But the interesting thing, and relating back to the Workers' Day theme for today, is that he was such a hard-working musician. Mm. If you watch that documentary, he was involved in every aspect of that tour. He was meticulous about every dance move, about every piece of choreography, every piece of visual. He was involved in every aspect of that
Sheldon,
of that show.
I have to tell you, you know, it's interesting for me. This comes up all the time with the greatest of the greats.
Mm.
How they have this very bad reputation with the people they work with. Everybody's saying when they are difficult to work with. That's what makes them superstars.
Exactly.
It's the meticulousness, it's the detail, it's that they will not allow anything slip.
Exactly.
That's what makes them great.
Exactly.
We love them and we don't like them at the same time. But that's exactly what makes them so great.
And I think that's the big thing. Like, people will often aspire for greatness. They'll say, oh, I want to be...
But you don't understand how much you have to invest of yourself.
Exactly. And how much work you need to put in. It doesn't just materialize.
And that's why sometimes people who envy those people start... If they get proximity to how much goes into the work... You're starting to hear murmurs of resentment, whatever, because mm-hmm. you actually don't appreciate just how much work goes behind what we see. Maybe it's an hour show.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just for a concert. Maybe it's 2 hour show. But so much has gone into that 2 hour show. So much has gone into it.
Exactly. And that was the thing that I took away from that documentary. It's actually the highest grossing documentary of all time. It generated $268 million at the box office. And then an additional $100 million just from DVD and Laserdisc sales. But watching it, you just are mind blown that someone even on his last legs... That he was so committed to the process. It was months of preparation. And the thing that blew my mind at that time and watching that documentary, which made me so emotional, is that there were so many people that were reliant on one person for a job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you and I have had this conversation where I asked you about the one musician when I said to you, you know, I kept thinking, my goodness, so many people rely on this young little person.
Mm.
Do they have any idea, you know? Do young people have any idea what that actually means?
Exactly.
If you have a cough, if she has a cough today and she cannot go to work...
You're all out.
Hundreds of people are not going to go to work.
And that was like musicians, dancers.
And if so many people are reliant on you, it's going to be tough for your handlers to accept that you've got a cough. It's going to be, you've got a cough, get over it, get up there.
Here's some drugs.
Yeah. Get up there.
Exactly. And that, I think the weight of that on Michael Jackson, knowing all of these people are, you know, like expecting so much from him. There were insurance companies, there were major corporations.
Security.
There were the so many people were reliant on him getting on that stage.
Yeah.
And I think that's a recurring story for Michael Jackson, because his brothers... In the lead up to that, the brothers would constantly come back to Michael Jackson and say, listen, we've run out of money. We need to go back on the road again. Will you come with us? And then he'd hit the road with them again to try and raise money for the brothers. So it was this ongoing thing. The same thing with Elvis Presley. Also, he was given drugs because there were so many people that were reliant on him to generate an income that... We're going to give you drugs to get on the stage. We're going to give you drugs to get off the stage. We're going to give you drugs to fall asleep. We're going to give you drugs to wake up. And that was Michael Jackson's existence the last few months of his life. Drugs to fall asleep, drugs to wake up, drugs to get on stage, etc., etc.
How sad.
Kaya 959. We are Rhythm and Beats.
Can't touch her. You just can't touch her. Rihanna.
Rihanna is a force of nature. I love her. I think she's great. I think she's a phenomenal multi-purpose person. I mean, she triple threat. She's an actress, she's a singer, and then she's also an entrepreneur with her Fenty brand. What I like about this song, it was from her Anti album, which was her 8th album. And what she had decided was, like, after her Unapologetic album, which was in 2012, this single was released in 2016, she decided she needed to take a break from music for a little while just so that she could, you know, like, try and get her creative bearings back. And so she started you know, thinking about songs. This song was actually written in one of those camps where like a whole lot of like people get together and write the song. And one of the guys in the camp, he was visiting Rihanna in her house in Malibu, and he played her this song, and she was like, oh, this song is fire. I want to sing it. Because the song was actually intended for Drake and Alicia Keys to do. But and then they never landed up doing it because Rihanna wanted to do it. I think that Rihanna has got, you know, something really, like, what the thing about her is that she was offering something very different from what people were used to at the time. And so this is what, you know, like, made her such a special artist. 14 number one hits, you know, within a very short period of time. And now it seems like she's changed her focus. And I think it's a symbol of, like, relating back to our theme about work. This specific song talks about, like, things don't come easily.
Yeah.
And if it's worth it, then you need to work for it. And in this instance, she's talking about love. But it applies to any kind of work. Like, if you want something badly enough, you need to work for it. It's not going to just materialize. And that's the theme of the song. And you, and looking at Rihanna's career, you can see that her focus has shifted. And that's the reality of anyone in a career. You're not always going to be doing the same thing. Also, mostly you're going to be, well, you should be exploring different avenues in order to continue being stimulated. Because if you're doing the same thing all of the time, you stop being innovative and creative. So the only way to grow as an individual and as someone who is trying to develop a career, it's important that you explore different things, because it's in that exploration that you're doing that you're getting ideas to enhance what you do on a daily basis. And that's specifically for creatives. It's a very big thing. Just like sticking to your specific art form the whole time is very limiting. You have to explore a plethora of different avenues in order to enhance and enrich your own creative process. So that's the Rihanna story. The song before that was Dolly Parton and Ladysmith Black Mambazo on a song called Knocking on Heaven's Door. So that song was released in 1997, but the way that the relationship between Ladysmith Black Mambazo and Dolly Parton started was in 1996, actually. A year before, Dolly Parton was releasing an album called Treasures, and she wanted to do a cover of a Cat Stevens song called Peace Train. And she approached Ladysmith Black Mambazo. They came on board. They did the song with her. And a year later, she returned the favor by appearing on their album and did this Knocking on Heaven's Door. The original version was done by Bob Dylan. And it was released in 1973, and it was from a motion picture soundtrack called Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. The song was a number 12 hit at that stage, and the Guns N' Roses version became the more popular version of Knocking on Heaven's Door. Now, relating back to our theme about Workers' Day and working, this all happened in Dolly Parton's career at a very, like, iffy time in her career. She was a 52-year-old rock star. Now, 52-year-old and rock star do not go together.
Yeah.
As we saw with Michael Jackson, he was in his 50s as well, and it was like people didn't believe he could do it, and he didn't. But Dolly Parton, she had reached that part in her career where the 1980s were really good for her. She had started her career in the 1960s. By the time she got to the 80s, where she had a second revival, it was like it came out of nowhere and people thought it was great, whatever. So the record company stayed with her. But the second she started getting stale, her record companies threw her out. They were like, you're old, you're tired, you have nothing to contribute. You're 52, you has been. You've been doing this for 30 years. Maybe you should just calm down. Anyway, that's when she came into contact with Ladysmith Black Mambazo and she shifted record companies. And the reason why she shifted, she went from Columbia to MCA, was because the guy at MCA really believed in Dolly Parton, believed that she could do great things. Anyway, she leaves, goes to MCA, and Treasures is released, but it's not like an earth-shattering album. But and then she releases 5 consecutive albums where she goes and this is, you know, relating back to the work thing, she goes and she reorientates herself, repositions herself as more of a bluegrass artist. Now, bluegrass is a very, like, thick version of country music. It's like the origins of country music. And she releases 5 albums. Hungry Again in 98, Precious Memories in 99, The Grass is Blue in 1999, 2 in the same year, Little Sparrow in 2001, and Halos and Horns in 2002. And all of a sudden, she's getting this massive critical acclaim. She, up to that point, she'd received 32 Grammy Award nominations and 4 awards. Within those 5 albums, she got 3 Grammy Awards and a plethora of nominations. She was back again, and she was at the top of her game once again, and she's now reaching her 60s. And it just goes to show that you've got to constantly be re-innovating and rethinking what your brand is in within your work environment, because people often get fixated with the work that they're doing right now, not understanding that there's a bigger picture and that what you do today and the seeds you are sowing today are going to articulate into great crops somewhere down the line.
Yeah.
And people oftentimes just get too fixated on the present.
Kelly Rowling.
No, the one with the real talent, actually.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about that, because the talent is not always enough.
Talent is definitely not always enough.
It's other things. Definitely. Work ethic, your hunger.
Yes.
And Beyonce has that in...
Yes.
Yeah, in buckets and buckets and bucket loads.
Yes, and that's what differentiates her from the rest of the other girls that were in the band.
Exactly.
Because Michelle Williams also...
Ambition.
Phenomenal voice.
She has ambition for days.
Yeah, and that really, at the end of the day...
That's the thing.
I often find that talent is 20%.
Overrated. 20%.
It's overrated.
Yep.
Most people that I've worked with who are talented never make it.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are not so talented are the ones that are willing to put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the big thing. Unfortunately, Kelly is super talented, brilliant voice, but, you know, trying to come out from under the shadow of Beyonce is really difficult because she's such a larger-than-life character. This song is actually quite interesting because it was released 2008. At around about that time, there was a lot of like interplay between like pop music and Bhangra music, like Indian music. You'd find a lot of like pop musicians experimenting with this like Bhangra sound, and there was quite a few that were releasing songs with that kind of like inspiration, like Madonna had much earlier with Erotica. Then Kylie Minogue even experimented with some Indian inspired sounds. You had Kelly Rowland, you had some, I think it was De La Soul, which was also experimenting with these like Asian, Eastern sounds. And there was like a big move towards this like Eastern Indian Bhangra kind of sound. And this song's got a little bit of that in it. It was produced by a team called the Freemasons. And the song is about you've got to put in the work.
Mm.
When she was originally asked about this, she said that the song was, you can't catch me easily. You need to work. You need to put in the work. You need to do your homework. You need to do etc. And people are like, oh, but isn't the song a little bit nasty? Like, doesn't it have a little bit of like a sexual connotation to it? And she was like, no. It's about like, if you want something badly enough, you need to work for it. And in this instance, once again, love. And then later on, many years later, she was like, now I feel confident in my sexuality. I'm going to tell you, this song is about sexual intercourse. So she changed her story, but we're going to go with the work theme because that's what we're talking about today. Right. The song before that was Erykah Badu. I am the most massive Erykah Badu
featuring Drake.
Yeah. Erykah Badu, Bag Lady.
Oh yes. Rihanna was featuring Drake.
Yeah. And so anyway, this song was written by Erykah Badu and Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes, the iconic funk artist from the 1970s. He was part of that whole blaxploitation movie like genre. He was the guy who wrote the theme for Shaft. Anyway, this was from Erykah Badu's second album, Mama's Gun, which was released in 2000. And it is considered a critically acclaimed album. It is considered the female alternative to D'Angelo's Voodoo album.
Mm.
Both very iconic albums. Voodoo is an exceptional album. Mm. If you haven't listened to it, go listen to it. It is brilliant. Anyway, the album was recorded at about the same time as Voodoo and Common's album Like Water for Chocolate and Bilal's Firstborn Second. And actually they were recording part of the album was recorded at Electric Lady Studios in New York, which was Jimi Hendrix's recording studio, and was actually the studio was designed by a South African called Eddie Kramer. He designed the studio and he actually managed the studio for Jimi Hendrix post Jimi Hendrix's passing, because although Jimi Hendrix had commissioned the recording studio in his lifetime, and Warner Brothers paid millions of dollars to get the studio made up for Jimi Hendrix specifically, he only ever used it for a week and then passed away.
Wow.
So when Jimi Hendrix passed away, Eddie Kramer became the manager of the recording studio. But Erykah Badu is from the South, and so she spent some time also recording the album in Atlanta. And in Atlanta, D'Angelo, Common, and Bilal were all recording their albums at the same time, these three very iconic albums. And so they all formed like a collective where they collaborated with each other and on each other's albums. And they actually formed a collective called the Soulquarians, which was, it was Questlove, it was D'Angelo, it was Bilal, it was Talib Kweli, and they all collaborated on each other's albums. So it's this beautiful, like, sometimes you've got to share the love with other people around you for greater greatness, you know, and that's the process of work. That's the process of creativity. That's how you create great, amazing albums, is by working with all of these amazing individuals who can feed beautiful creativity into what you're doing and offer an alternate perspective. And that is what happened with this specific album, Mama's Gun, and Bag Lady. The song is about emotional baggage and not walking into a relationship with emotional baggage. Now, to give context, at the time, just before this album was released, Erykah Badu was dating a guy called Andre 3000, who was one half of Outkast. And they had a child together. Actually, Erykah Badu's only child, I think. His name is Seven. Anyway, and they had the child together, and then they broke up. And so she went into writing this album with a lot of emotional baggage. And so this specific song, Bag Lady, is about like not carrying those bags with you and just leaving them at the door and moving forward and leaving the baggage behind so that you can experience other things. Because the problem with baggage is it precludes you from experiencing new things and being able to move forward. And essentially what happened is, by leaving the bags at the door, she was able to collaborate with all these phenomenal musicians and deliver this phenomenal product, Mama's Gun. Kaya.
Donna Summer.
Yeah. She's an amazing character because she's the queen of disco, you always expect that the voice is going to be very like, dance musicians aren't known for brilliant voices, but Donna Summer had a phenomenal voice, and that's why she was the queen of disco. This specific song was from a movie called Thank God It's Friday, 1978. And in the 1970s, there were these cult movies that actually shifted popular consciousness. This movie, Thank God It's Friday, and Saturday Night Fever, and Grease were three of those movies that were seminal in like the shifting of like how people interact with music, how people interact with culture, etc. And this song landed up winning the Academy Award for Best Original Song, the Golden Globe for Best Original Song, and the Grammy Award for Best Female R&B Performance. So it won many awards, but Donna Summer did not want to record it. She did not want to record the song. She was very reluctant. And eventually what happened was Paul Jabara, the guy who wrote the song, and Bob Etsy, they cornered her in her hotel room in Brazil. It was Puerto Rico. And they locked her in the bathroom and they played her the track. And they said, listen to it properly. And then she was like, okay, I'll record the song. And it landed up becoming this big hit for her. Now, the whole thing that made this song so different from other disco songs is that it starts as a ballad. So when you listen to the song, you're expecting that it's going to be a ballad. But then as the song progresses, it then becomes a dance song. And David Foster played a session on this track. And he wasn't a famous producer at the time. He landed up becoming a very famous producer. But when he was playing on this track, he was playing piano, he said, that's the worst idea. Like starting off as a ballad and then going into a dance song, you're going to lose the audience, because the whole thing with disco was that you needed to keep the audience on the floor the whole time. So if you're starting with a ballad, you're going to clear the floor. People are not going to be interested. Anyway, he was wrong. And the song became this massive hit. And the whole thing about the bringing it back to work is that sometimes you've got to believe in what you do. Mm. Because people are going to tell you, sorry, it's not going to work. Mm. Sorry, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you don't know what you're talking about. And you've got to believe in what you're doing. Mm. We saw it with Dolly Parton and with her believing in herself. We're now seeing it with Donna Summer, the same thing. And you've got to, not Donna Summer, but Paul Jabara specifically, he believed in what he had done. He believed that the song was the right song for her at that specific time. And by believing in it and being forceful about it, he got what he wanted, and it was a huge success. Sometimes, because there's so much noise surrounding what we do every day, we sometimes second guess what we want to do or what we believe we should do because the noise is telling us otherwise. Yeah. Yeah. And so from a worker's perspective, just believe in what you're doing. And if you're doing the right thing, the cream will always rise to the top.
Sheldon, it's always lovely to have you.
Thank you very much.
And how do we leave the studio?
So we're going to end with one of my favorite artists. His name is Tom Misch. And the song that we're listening to is The Journey.
Thanks, everybody. We're back on Monday at 8.
On the street, on the air, on the go. Download the Kaya app. Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.